The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 150.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, one of my great buddies here on YouTube. He really needs no introduction. I'm sure you guys have seen his videos many, many times. His name is Mark Moss. Mark, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, buddy.
Yeah, George, thanks so much for having me back. It's always a pleasure sitting down and talking to you.
Yeah, so for my viewers who might not know your full backstory, it's really, really interesting how you got to this point in life. Can you go over that quickly?
Yeah, I'm going to go over it real quickly. So I started investing in real estate when I was 18 years old. Luckily, they say your network is your net worth, and I had a buddy, and I kind of drafted off of him. And I also started businesses. I had Fortune 500 exits. I figured out how to make money really, really good.
Yeah.
From 1995 to 2005, I had amassed a massive empire. By 2008, I got wiped out. And that's because I knew how to make money, but I didn't understand this financial casino thing that was going on. Right. And so it made, you know, I'm a dirt bike racer. I've broken every bone in my body, and I'm used to just kind of dusting myself off. So I said, okay, let me figure out what the heck this whole thing is, because this is never going to happen to me again. And so I started really digging in deep, and that's where I really found Mike Maloney and Peter Schiff, and started finding about gold and why this system is the way it is without having a sound money system. And so I just devoured that information, because I realized that money transfers, and I was on the losing end of the transfer. And I vowed to never let that happen again. I would be on the receiving end from that point forward. Chasing sound money, chasing the financial system led me into Bitcoin. I was kind of an early adopter there, 2014, 2015. I tweeted last night that there was the gold Bitcoin ratio. And right now it takes about 5 ounces of gold to buy one Bitcoin. Mm. When I started, you could buy 5 Bitcoin for 1 ounce of gold. Kind of interesting. But anyway, so I've been doing that for a while. And for the last couple of years, I've just been writing financial information, trying to help people, because I believe that everything we've been taught is wrong.
Yeah.
And that's a big statement. But I mean, from health to fitness, to making money, to growing your money, everything we've been told is wrong. And so we need to learn how to look at things differently. I try to educate people and just try to open up people's mind. And so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. So on that note, before we go any farther, we've got a huge announcement to make.
We do.
And this video should be airing on Monday, but this Saturday, you and I are going to be doing a live meetup right here in Phoenix, Arizona. So, I mean, this is going to be I'm super, super excited about it. We're going to go out to a place called Top Golf. Believe it or not. It's funny because I always make fun of them on my videos, but it is a really, really cool place. And I went there last night, and there's an area that we can reserve where you don't have to have a mask and you can get drinks and play golf and everything. So you're flying in. It's going to be great. What are your thoughts on that? I'm super, super excited.
Well, I'm super excited. I mean, you and I've had you on, you've had me on. We've had a bunch of talks offline. We've never actually got to hang out. So I'm super excited from that. We're also getting to go by Robert Kiyosaki's office and hang out with him, which I'm super excited about. So it's gonna be a fun weekend. But you and I have a lot of the same audience, because we talk about a lot of the same stuff. And I know you just got back from the Red Pill Expo, so we're gonna just continue on with that. And anybody who wants to know about how to survive and thrive through this time of chaos, then you definitely need to show up. We don't really have anything planned, no agenda. But come ask questions. If you want to hear from us, ask questions. Now's the time to show up.
Yeah. Just a basic meetup. You can, hang out with us. You can hit some golf balls. You can grab some beers. We might have some food there. It's going to be a super, super fun time. There's no, fees. Just show up and enjoy yourself. So I think you're going to set up a landing page to give some more details. And if guys, if you're thinking about coming to this, if you do us a huge favor, and just let us know that you're going to be here, just RSVP, and we'll have information on how to do that on this landing page that Mark will set up. And all of the editors put it across the screen right now. We'll put it in the pinned comment, also in the description below. So with that out of the way, hopefully we can see as many people there as possible this Saturday in Phoenix, Arizona. But I want to get into your thoughts on just kind of everything that we really focus on and our audience is all about, because it's been so long since I'd have the opportunity to talk to you. So what's going on right now with Bitcoin? Let's start there. I know you're really heavy duty in that space. So what's going on with the price? What are your views on it?
Yeah, so I started writing research reports on Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies in about 2014. So it's been about 6 years. I've really been studying it really hard. It's an interesting time for Bitcoin. Like I said, I kind of started with gold because of the sound money. And right now what we're seeing is massive monetary stimulus, money printing, if you want to call it that. And every time they do that, it pushes the narrative as to why we need back to a sound money system, right?
Yep.
So gold and Bitcoin seem to be the flavors of the day. For sure, gold, a renewed interest, but of course, Bitcoin is there. As far as what's going on with it, as far as price action goes, I say, I'm sure you would agree with me, you know, we're looking at kind of the macro picture and trying to be where the puck is going to be, so to speak. And so, you know, daily short-term noise, and it distracts you from what's really going on. Everybody's like focused on, well, the dollar's getting stronger, so gold and Bitcoin are going to go down. And it's like, dude, the strength of the dollar doesn't really matter. This, like, there's so many other drivers, right?
Yeah, right.
So the price had dipped, along with the stock market, everything else back in March. The stock market had to be saved with circuit breakers to keep it from going down. And it took trillions of dollars of stimulus to get it back up. Bitcoin didn't. Bitcoin recovered on its own. Every time it doesn't die makes it that much stronger.
Yeah.
So every time Bitcoin doesn't die, it bounces back, it makes it much stronger. We reclaim the important 10,000 threshold. And what we have, and it's very interesting with Bitcoin, because we're watching an infinite amount of money supply being created on a schedule that we don't know, right? They create as much as they want. At the same time, we're watching Bitcoin, which has a fixed supply, a cap, 21 million cap, but it does have a set inflation schedule. So it is inflating, but on a schedule with a cap. And what's interesting is we're watching in real time the increase, the infinite increase of money, and we're watching the decrease of Bitcoin at the same time. So every 4 years, the inflation supply goes down. And so it's an interesting phenomenon that we're watching play out in real time. And I'm irrationally long, as Ralph Powell said.
Yeah, you know what I think would be a fun chart would be if you could layer on top of a chart of the price of Bitcoin, a chart of M2 money supply.
Yeah.
You've seen that with gold. And I think I was talking to Lynn Alden the other day, and she had a great point that if you look at that ratio of the M2 money supply compared with gold, gold was actually pretty expensive back in the last bull market at the top, you know, 2011, something like that. And, gold, the price was quite a bit higher than that M2 money supply line on the chart. But now the M2 money supply is actually higher than the price of gold. So a lot of people say that, well, gold is just as expensive as it was in 2011, if you look at it in nominal terms.
Right.
Yes, to a certain extent. But if you look at the amount of money that's out there chasing that 1 ounce bar of gold, then there's way, way, way more currency units. So I think people need to think that through as well. So I think that would be fascinating to see how that would work with Bitcoin. Obviously, you know, M2 would be going up like this, and the chart of Bitcoin would be going back down, implying that it's cheap relative to the amount of dollars.
Yeah, and you know what? That is a very interesting way to look at it, and more people need to kind of figure that out, because they think that everything is getting more expensive, but really it's just taking more dollars to buy those things. Mm. And so you just kind of have to retrain your brain to look at things a little bit differently to kind of see that picture.
Yeah, you know, you get a ton of views, a ton of comments on your videos as well. So I'm sure that you see this same type of feedback. But people are always saying, well, if the Fed's going to print limitless money and they're going to do QE and they're going to do stimulus or whatever, then shouldn't we be long the stock market, because the stock market has to go up? But it really hits on the point you just made, where they're looking at things in nominal terms. Mm-hmm. And they're not looking at things in real terms. You know, going back to the Venezuelan stock market, that went up, what, a million times?
Right.
You wouldn't want to own it because your purchasing power got shrunk quite a bit. Can you kind of explain that? Do you have that same experience with the people who watch your videos? The kind of mindset?
all the time. I mean, I probably, and we talked about this offline. I mean, I was combing through my comments on YouTube. I used to try to reply to every single one, but now there's just too many. It's probably 5,000 comments a week, but I do skim through them and try to do what I can. And so the comments make me want to do more videos, right? Try to help people, but you're absolutely right. It comes down to that mindset and the way that you look at it. And, you know, one thing that's easy, kind of, if I put it into perspective, is like, you know, I have $100 trillion banknote from Zimbabwe.
Right.
So like, just because you have $1 million or $1 billion or $1 trillion doesn't mean it's worth anything. And so, you know, I'm older, right? So like, I remember when like being a millionaire used to be something. And today, especially where I live in Southern California, a millionaire is like middle class almost, which is hard to say, right? But you make $1 million, half of that goes to taxes. You're living on 500 grand. The average home price in my area is 2 million bucks. Like, how do you live on half of, you know? So anyway, it's not what it used to be. And so the way that I like to explain it very simply is this. It's not about the value or the price. Think about it in purchasing power. Mm-hmm. So, right, in if you took the median home price in 1960 and then you compared that to dollars, but also compare it to how many ounces of gold, how many barrels of oil, a basket of groceries, et cetera. And now what's the median home price today compared to that same basket of goods? And so really think about your purchasing power. And even when, you know, some of these economists like, you know, Harry Dent loves to talk about gold's going to crash to $1,000 or whatever. And so in a deflationary environment, yes, the price of gold would most likely come down in dollars terms, but the purchasing power would go up.
Mm.
And it's hard to get your mind around, but that's important to understand.
Oh, it's huge. It's everything. So on that note, what do you see coming in the future, maybe near term, long term, with inflation or disinflation or outright deflation?
The $1 million question that
let me clarify, as measured by consumer prices, because we could be talking about consumer prices, we could be talking about assets, or we could be talking about the dollar relative to other currencies. So just in relation to consumer prices.
Yeah. So that's the $1 million question. You interview a ton of people trying to ask that question, as do I, not as many people as you do. But the way that I see it, if I'm going to put it out there, is I see, first of all, these are very nuanced conversations. Yeah. So people want things to be black and white. Real estate's going to go up. Real estate's going to go down. It's not that simple, right? So these are nuanced conversations. But what I would say is I'm looking at two possible scenarios. People that I talk to and even what I believe is that we're going to have this massive deflationary move, maybe upwards of an 80% drawdown in the stock market. You know, most of real estate will probably get crushed, et cetera. I give that maybe a 60% probability. Like that's probably the consensus that I'm seeing in the market. What I interview people in the way that I see it. So that's about a 60% probability. The other probability is you had somebody on talking about MMT. And the other probability is that we don't have that. And what we see is prices go up 2-3 times or more from here. And that would be because the government just bypasses the banks, puts money directly out to the people, which we're already seeing, which I know we're going to talk about, which is, you know, with digital currencies, because they're here, they're coming. And the Fed is going to bypass banks, put money to the people. And so we could see prices go double, triple from here or more. And I give that a lower probability, maybe more of like a 20% probability. But those are the two scenarios that I see playing out. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that if you talk to guys like Steve, the Bond King, or Brent Johnson, or Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Luke Groman, people that I really enjoy talking to that are a heck of a lot smarter than I am, it's really they agree on the fundamentals. And they agree pretty much on 99.9% of how it's all laid out as far as the plumbing. But the slight, I don't even want to say disagreement, where they kind of differ a little is how they interpret the Federal Reserve Act. And then their confidence level of the Fed either abiding by the Federal Reserve Act or just completely ignoring it.
Yeah.
So if you're on the side of, well, I think the Fed and the government is going to have to live within our current framework, then you've got to be on the deflation side, or at least the disinflation.
Yeah.
But if you're on the side that says, okay, well, I think the Fed just going to completely ignore the Federal Reserve Act, they're going to do whatever they need to do to prop up the markets as far as creating base money, they're going to go to this digital currency, then you've got to be on the side of inflation, or I would kind of lean more toward the stagflationary side. That's kind of how I see the whole quote unquote debate. It's not really a debate.
You said it a little bit better than I would. I would make it a little bit more simple, but we do understand the fundamentals, right? So the economy is slowing, there's no GDP, the stimulus is having diminishing returns, like, you know, we're at zero rates, like the fundamentals should things over, right? We're ready for the correction. There's not much they can do. That's the fundamentals, which is why I give that a higher probability. What we don't know is what's inside 12 guys' minds in a room somewhere in DC.
Exactly.
And there's just no way to know that. They can just decide tomorrow to print $1 trillion by. So an example of that would be, everyone says the real estate market's going to crash because everyone's out of work and everyone's missing their payments. It has to crash, right? Okay, it does. But what if they decide to print $1 trillion and just pay off everybody's mortgage?
Yeah.
Like, that's a simplistic view, but they could capitalize the banks and not have foreclosure for 5 years. They can give BlackRock money and they could buy up the mortgages. Yeah. So like, they might do that. And so like, you can't just say the market's going to crash because there's a good chance they might pull something crazy out of their hat like that. And what we don't know, but what we do know, and I always like to break things down to the most basic, is what we do know is human nature, right? We do know human nature, and we do know that the Fed is, in my opinion, going to go until they blow, I like to say. They're not going to wake up tomorrow and decide to live on a budget, and so they've gone too far, and so this massive money printing is going to happen. I think the bigger question is it going to happen after the big drop, or will it happen before the big drop?
Yeah, there's got to be a deleveraging. That's one thing everyone agrees on, whether it's an inflationary deleveraging or a deflationary deleveraging. There's just so much debt in the system. You've got to figure out a way to reduce that debt load. You know, what's interesting.
But you don't have to. Right. What they're talking about now with this, you know, this new Bretton Woods thing they're talking about just the last couple of days. I mean, they could just talk about like taking all that debt, kind of like what they did in 2008, where the Fed comes in and takes all the bad debt off of their books. So the debt's like still there somewhere, like in this world on someone else's book. So it never deleveraged necessarily. It just kind of got moved. And what if they could just take all this debt and push it onto the IMF's books, or, you know, the BIS holds it somewhere over whatever. And so like, it's kind of like the debt deleveraged, but maybe it didn't.
Right. Or a debt jubilee. Where the Fed just buys all the bonds and then just hits delete, you know, because the bonds or the treasuries are a liability on the government's balance sheet and they're an asset on the Fed's balance sheet. And if the Fed can have negative equity, then they just delete, they're all gone. You go from $27 trillion in debt down to zero, you're good to go. But I mean, there's so many knock-on effects to that. Most people really... even the kind of the MMT people that are might be proponents of that, I don't think have really thought through what that would do to the repo market. What collateral do you use for the dollar funding market? They don't really understand how that would play out downstream. But, you know, that's kind of the thought experiment as far as a debt jubilee.
Well, I think that recent developments, and when I say recent, you know, last 6 months or so, have kind of shifted the whole financial system or what the financial system can be. And so what I see is, you know, again, being in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency for a really long time. And even if I back up, I started an e-commerce business in 2001. Mm-hmm. And I went to these brands, hey, I want to sell your products on my website. And they laughed at me. No one would ever buy anything online. That's stupid. I'm like, I lived through that, right? Like, I've been here. And I heard the same thing with cryptocurrency. And I think we have a lot of these old financial people that have been analyzing the market for a long time, and they're debating what can the Fed do and what about the debt and all these things. What's happened in just the last really couple of months is now with the central bank digital currencies and the acts. I mean, China already pushed it out last week to the public.
Why don't you go into that video, Mark, that you did just the other day? That was really, really a cool video.
Yeah, I'll dive into that. But I think so. What will set the stage for, I think, changes things moving forward, and it removes a lot of the constraints that we have in the financial system today, where people are like, "Well, will the Federal Reserve Act? Can they get around it? Can they not? You know, all these things." But like, the technology now allows us to move past this, and we have the World Economic Forum with their Great Reset, and now the IMF with Bretton Woods. They're all talking about this, and at the same time, they're talking about the technology is here, and so. The world, I saw this, I think it was Jim Rickards. He said, the world we're going into is not the world that we've come out of.
Mm-hmm.
And that was powerful. But before we have that whole conversation, talking about that video real quickly. So for most people, it's probably not a big surprise that the Chinese, you know, PBOC, the People's Bank of China, has been working on a digital currency for quite some time. They were the first one to really come out and announce that they were going to do it. Of course, they would be the first one to do that because they have this captured, you know, economy, captured country where they can kind of control that. And so they've been working on this central bank digital currency. And I like that word better. It's a CBDC, better than a cryptocurrency because it's not a crypto. Right, it's not a cryptocurrency. So it's a central bank digital currency. And they started testing it in small markets, but last week it actually went public. And what they did was basically, how do we, kind of like in 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act, how do we get people to use these fake dollars? Let's come up with a plan. And kind of the same plan, how do we get people to use the CBDCs? Well, they said, what we'll do is we'll give away 10 million yuan. It was like 2 million bucks, 2 million USD. So they said, we'll give away this money, and it's going to be like this lottery system, and you have to like download the app, the digital bank currency wallet, and then if you get this, what was it called, red shirt or red wallet or whatever it was, if you get this special thing, then you win, and you get 200 bucks or whatever it was. But everybody had to download the wallet, right? How they got everybody in. So everybody has to download the wallet. You have to see if you're a winner, and then if you are, you get a couple hundred bucks. But now everybody's using it, and that was released into the wild on October 12th, I believe.
Oh, I see. So you had to actually download the app to see if you got the free money.
Yeah.
So obviously everyone's downloading. Oh, geez. Yeah. Wow.
Now in China, they already have so much surveillance with their WeChat and, you know, all the different things. They're kind of already living in that digital world, and their government controls them so much. Maybe for them, it wasn't that big of a stretch, but I would imagine the U.S. is also going to need to do something pretty drastic to get people to jump into that as well.
Yeah, well, you talked about that on your video. I mean, I think it's just stimulus and more UBI or whatever you want to call it. You know, that if you want the free $2,000 a month, then you just need to download this onto your phone. But I think that people need to understand, if you're downloading that app onto your phone, basically what you're doing is you're setting up a bank account with the central bank. So all those, you know, Chinese folks that thought that they were getting, you know, or potentially getting a free money, so they need to be a part of this lottery. When they download that from iTunes or whatever it is, they're setting up an account basically at the PBOC, in which case they would have a record of every single one of their transactions. So just imagine that the Fed had your bank statements every single month. And that goes straight to the IRS, that goes straight to the government. So that's really what's going on here, because that's how they get the money into your account, by just creating bank reserves that go right into that account, then you can go ahead and spend it. So I just wanted to make that point, because it's very, that's I think the crucial thing to understand, is that every American would have an account actually at the Fed.
Yeah, and that's a really big thing. And you had made a video probably a year ago about the end of cash, and talking about how the central banks were trying to kind of roll power up and maybe get rid of the small banks first and then get rid of the big commercial banks second. And you were talking about getting the end of cash and why they would want to do that. But that was like a year ago, before this whole CBDC thing popped up or anything. And really now I think that video is even more relevant today, because now they have the technology to do exactly what you were talking about, but in a much faster time. So the central bank sets up a wallet and gives money directly to the people and bypasses all the people in between.
The commercial banks, yeah.
All the commercial banks, you know, and they just get rid of them and they do one-on-one. And so, you know, we can talk about that whole thing as to what that means when you lose all that decentralization of banks and then you have a centralized bank. But in addition, I think a lot of people don't realize that part of the thing with cash, obviously, is that, you know, it's a bearer instrument, right? I can hand it to somebody, nobody can control it or stop it, which is why they don't like that. The thing with CBDCs is that they're programmable money. And so what that means is it's actually programmable. So for example, hey, you get $1,200 in stimulus, but if you don't spend it within 7 days, the money comes back to us.
Yeah, velocity.
for example, right? Or, hey, you get $1,200 a week, but if you don't spend it, then we're only going to top you back up or whatever, right? So then they could force that velocity, like you're saying, force that spending. They can also say, hey, you're not allowed to spend that money on this, this, and this. You're only allowed to spend the money on this, this, and this. So you're only allowed to shop at Walmart and Target. You can't shop at mom and pops, for example. You know, things like that. Oh, you can't support political thing, whether they're right or left. You can't pay, you know, so whatever. They can program exactly what you can do with your money. Of course, you mentioned the IRS, so they could just take taxes out right in the middle of that transaction. I mean, there's no end to the amount of control that could be put into it.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Let's go back, because you touched on something that I think is also extremely important. And that's that the fact that we currently, well, even more so before 2008, but we had this system set up where the commercial banking system created the majority of the money supply. In and outside the United States with the euro dollar system. But that's a whole other video and topic for conversation. But so if you think and why that's good is because the commercial bank, especially the local regional banks, and I need to give it huge props and a hat tip to Richard Warner, because this is all his idea. Well, I studied his stuff and then just did whiteboard videos on it. This is all, you know, through Richard Warner's research. So, you know, hat tip to Richard for sure. But basically, if you've got the small community banks creating these loans, they're going to do it with individuals who they have a relationship with. So if you've got that entrepreneur that's coming in that's wanting to start X, Y, you know, the bank's going to have that relationship. They're going to know that guy. Maybe they knew him in high school. They're going to know how good of a credit risk is that he is or she is. And they're going to have a much better grasp of what's going on in the local economy. Therefore, that bank can facilitate good, solid, fundamental growth in that little local area. And then you just have that all around the entire country. And that's how you facilitate lending that creates solid economic growth. And where limited resources are being allocated efficiently, the most efficient way possible. You juxtapose that to what we're talking about now with them eliminating the commercial banks and centralizing everything. Now you're going to have a massive distortion in the economy because these resources won't be allocated, because how can the Fed know, how can they possibly have all the information that all of those community banks would have had on who to give a loan to and who not to give a loan to?
Exactly. And you take that conversation and you multiply it across every other area in the economy in the nation. So when I started out, I said, everything you've been told is wrong. And a lot of that is because of the way it's been managed. So everything needs to be managed on a local level. So your example is perfectly right. Like, this local banker says, hey, this business guy wants to open up this business. Well, that local banker knows, you know what, that business is way too saturated. Like, you want to open a shipbuilding business in Kansas? No, it's never going to work in Kansas, right? So the banker is responsible for those loans. And we can talk about why the banks aren't lending money out today, right? But there's too much risk. So the bank is kind of on the hook for those loans a little bit. And so they need to also manage that money properly. And on a local level, they can do that. But how can that be done on a national level? But the same can be said about our education system. Same could be said about our healthcare system and all these different things. And so the more centralized power that we continue to have in every area, the more negative effects that we continue to see.
Yeah, that's for sure. And what do you think would happen if the central banks were the only banks, let's say, and print these bank reserves so they can basically give limitless loans and they don't have to be repaid because they can take, there is no profit and loss with a central bank to the degree that they would go out of business if they're taking a haircut like a normal bank. So do you think we could get into this zone, this really weird space where they're giving out these loans not based on your credit score or your ability to pay them back with interest, but they're doing it more so on things like a social score?
Well, definitely that. And I see it even going even somewhere bigger, deeper, darker, and even more dangerous. And that is, we're talking about getting rid of the grassroots banks and moving to large commercial banks, and then moving to government central banks. But I believe where this is going is not to government central banks that are sovereign, but moving towards world banks.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that's really where I think this technology is going. And that's why we see the IMF talking about this last weekend, the new Bretton Woods Agreement. Right. What is the Bretton Woods Agreement? That was what put the entire world onto one money system. Right. The gold system based off the dollar. And now a new gold standard is like the whole world being back on this. And I think it eventually goes to like the BIS having their SDRs that are basically each country gets a percentage in the SDR, and the SDR is the CBDC.
So that's the Bretton Woods 2. Instead of the dollar, it's now the SDR.
And for those of us that have been watching this game unfold for 20 plus years, we know that, you know, people have been talking about for years the New World Order and the UN and the One World Government, etc. But I mean, that's, it's not crazy talk. It's been in development, and that's where it's going. And once we have this CBDC and this new Bretton Woods Agreement through the BIS, I mean, that's where it goes. Like, why wouldn't it go there?
Yeah. And I'd also like to remind everyone, too, that back in Bretton Woods 1, Keynes was in favor of something called Bancor. And Bancor was a one world currency. And he was in favor of it because he was thinking through Triffin's paradox. Mm-hmm. And he knew that if there was one country with the world reserve currency, that they would always be kind of in that weird position where do you just create enough currency for your own country and therefore kind of the rest of the world be damned? Or do you create enough money or currency for the rest of the world, which really hollows out your manufacturing base and eventually destroys your own economy and then incentivizes other countries to not use currency, which is just kind of this catch 22, you know, Triffin's dilemma, Triffin's paradox. So my point is let's just assume for a moment these global elites have good intentions. Maybe that's what they're thinking through, that, oh, Triffin's paradox, we don't want to do that again. So we need to go back to Keynes's idea on bank core. So that will be the SDR, and we'll just do it digitally, because then everyone across the globe will have to have an account with them. And therefore, they'll know and be able to control every single transaction. You know, the way they'll probably sell that, Mark, is that they're, and because I kind of hear this, these overtones with their Great Reset videos that I've watched, and the one with the gal from the IMF about the Bretton Woods 2 thing, about how there's all these people across the world that are unbanked, mm-hmm. you know, across Africa and Asia and South America. And we need to get these people into the banking system. And they spin it as though this is going to create a booming economy and everything. But that's maybe how they'll sell it. Well, now we'll set up everything at the IMF or the World Bank or who knows where, the centralized location, because we can easily give these people a bank account of their own because they just have to download the app on their phone. What do you think about that?
Well, first off, I would say that being a Bitcoin guy, we've been talking about the unbanked for a long time. There's per the UN, there's about 2 billion adults. 2 billion adults in the world without access to banking. But the reason why most people don't have access to banking is because the banking system is permissioned. I have to have permission to join the banking, or I have to fill out all the forms, and they have to hopefully allow me to join it. And that's why the majority of people aren't in the financial system. If you're a 16-year-old kid and you're growing up in Iraq or Iran, for example, you're not allowed to join the financial system. I'm sorry. You're in Iran. You don't get to join, right? And so by them saying there's more inclusion, that's just not going to be the case. The problem isn't they live in some, you know, hut in Africa and don't have access to a greenback, and now a digital wallet saves them. That's not the problem. The problem is access and permission. But back to, I guess, what you were just kind of talking about, and actually where we kind of started about how does this play out? And I said that technology now allows this inflation world to exist. So how would the IMF or the BIS get these countries to give up their own central bank and join? How would they do that? And it's the same way it's going to work all the way down to the individual person. Maybe I'm thinking this through, but let's say that you're Greece and now you're overextended and now you need to negotiate austerity and you're bankrupt. Well, per the IMF or the BIS, well, hey, you know what? Sorry, you're broke. No bailouts for you. What we will do, though, is we'll take all your debt and we'll give you this brand new currency to use. Next country. Oh, you're broke. No bailouts for you. But what we will do is we'll swap your debt for this new SDR debt. And they'll just take out each person one by one by one. And I was even thinking on a person-to-person level, when the banks start to fail, let's say that they do roll this up, so we start locally, and the banks start failing, well, FDIC kicks in, right? Well, to get your FDIC money, download the app, right? And that's how, that you want your money back, download the app. And then I think that just rolls up all the way, whether that's a local bank going bankrupt or it's a government, a country going bankrupt, and like, hey, we'll swap your debt. And I see this game of almost musical chairs where this debt jubilee, where they're just absorbing this debt from these governments, rolling it into the SDR, putting it onto a book somewhere off the shelf, and giving them a fresh new money to use.
Also, too, going back to the putting the local banks out of business or retail banks, is negative interest rates, because they drop rates negative, and the retail banks that make money by borrowing short and lending long, they got big problems. I mean, they're not going to be around. We see the problems that they're having in Japan, in Europe, with negative interest rates now that are just, let's call it 100 basis points or 50 basis points negative. But goodness gracious, if they did this digital currency and then banned cash and they take rates down to -5 or something, I mean, the banks, unless they're an investment bank, they're not going to last long with that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's all happening really fast. And again, going back to, you asked me kind of where are we at with Bitcoin. And like I said, I've been, you know, writing about it now for 5-6 years. And it's like one of those things that gradually, then suddenly. And, you know, people, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. I like things I can hold in my hand. I like real tangible things. Digital money never worked. We hear that stuff. But this is here. China launched it to the public on the 12th. What was that? 7 days ago. Like, it's here. I believe in the U.S. it's coming out probably the next 6 to 9 months. Like, it's already written into the laws. Like, it's, or it was put in the bill, into the stimulus bill. Like, it's coming. Whether you like it or not, you can choose to believe it. What do they say? You can choose to ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of it. And yeah. So you can choose to believe this isn't happening, but it's happening.
Yeah, that's a great point. So do you think what they're doing with the World Economic Forum, this Great Reset plan that they have, I mean, when I look, it's just all just gibberish and nonsense. But when you get to kind of how they're trying to centralize power, you see that, my goodness, they're just destroying economy. If they were able to execute on this, it would just destroy economies in a very quick fashion. And then also the banking system, if they're taking rates negative. So do you think that that's kind of their game plan, that they're trying to maybe have this creative destruction where they destroy it, therefore the only bailout, let's say, for a country or a central bank would be to go to these central planners, these global elites, and then they control everything through this destruction?
Yes, something like that. Yeah, I think you mentioned earlier, like, this debt jubilee, and I think we're going to see that debt jubilee where, like, hey, your debt's forgiven, but now you have to take this new currency. And I think that we're going to see that. I'm sure, like you, I get messaged a lot from viewers and people, and hey, you need to check this out. You need to check this out. And it's tough to, like, cut through the chase and what's real and what's not and how much supporting evidence can I find. But there's talk of that even happening on, like, a more of a local level where, like, hey, we'll get rid of your mortgage debt, your auto loan debt, your student loan debt, et cetera. This debt jubilee for the people. But, like, you got to be willing to give up control of your private property. And when you look at what the Great Reset talks about, they envision a world where we don't own anything, right?
Right.
That's what they say. It's on their website. This is not conspiracy. It's on their website. So they envision this world where we don't own anything. And of course, the Marxists believe that private property is bad anyway, right? And so what they do from a maybe a IMF AS level is basically get the whole world to give up everything. They own everything and they just give out money and everybody just has money and doesn't own anything. And I know that sounds really far out, but it's written down.
What do you think about this? I went through a video the other day and I was thinking through this idea of the main problem that they had with the communism they tried to implement in Russia, as an example. Obviously, there are tons and tons of problems. But one of the biggest problems they had is they couldn't, there was no price discovery. So they couldn't allocate resources. So, you know, in our market, as an example, if we have housing prices go up in one area substantially, like Denver, and then the prices of a 2x4 goes and doubles in that little area, then the people that are producing the 2x4s, then they know that they need to send more towards that area. So those resources are going to go to their highest use case. But if you don't have prices, you don't know where to send all this stuff. And that's why you had famine throughout Russia. It's one of the reasons. And they just couldn't allocate the resources, so the thing implodes. But what I was thinking is that if we all had an account with the Fed, they would know every single transaction. And if we've gotten AI to the point where it could crunch all of that data and then tell the central planners how to allocate those resources, in their mind, do you think they could see AI as a solution to the price discovery that a free market capitalist system creates? And therefore, if they can get over that hurdle, then we can move into this Marxist or socialist utopia, because we can just delegate our thinking and delegate our price discovery to AI, because we all have these accounts and all, you know, they're collecting all that data in real time.
I hadn't really thought about that.
I know that's a little bit, that's a little bit much.
It's not a little bit much because part of the World Economic Forum's Great Reset, they're pushing this fourth industrial revolution, right?
Right.
So when you look at the fourth industrial revolution, that's exactly what they're talking about. They envision a world where man and machine are one, and you can't even detect the difference. I mean, this is their world, not ours. And so this is a perfect segue, because why all those plans of rolling all this up and just swapping debt and that doesn't work is because you can't create money. Money is this organizer, as you're leading to. So I did make a video on my channel titled Income Inequality. It was a horrible title, which is why I didn't get a lot of views. But I was basically making the case that money is communication. Money coordinates an economy.
You're right.
So, the point, prices. Right, yeah. Price discovery. So you have 330 million people in the United States. Each one of them is making hundreds of decisions a day. Should I get vanilla ice cream or chocolate ice cream? I don't know. And how does the guy making the ice cream know how much chocolate and how much vanilla to make, right? So there's exactly 330 million people making decisions, hundreds of decisions a day on everything that you can imagine, and money coordinates that. And so what happens is the central bankers want to coordinate that. And what you're asking is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Can an AI do that better? And I would say no.
Well, I don't think it can do it better. I was just telling what may be going on in their minds.
I think that is very logical that it goes in their mind. And the reason why I think it does go on in their mind, and at the same time why it doesn't work, is because what central planners always disregard. I don't understand how they don't see this. The one thing they never get is human incentive and motivation.
Right.
They think they can control everything, but like, humans seem irrational. Like, I like chocolate one day, I like vanilla next. I don't know why, I just want vanilla, right? And humans need incentives. So what happens is if I decide I want chocolate, but now all of a sudden I want vanilla, well, there's not enough vanilla. So the guy that's selling the ice cream would increase the price of vanilla, and maybe I don't want vanilla anymore because it's too expensive, so maybe I go back to chocolate, or maybe I pay more. If enough people are paying more, then people that are making ice cream go, shoot, I should go make more vanilla. Right? And they'll respond to that need in the market. Where the AI or the central planners go wrong is they leave out the incentive or the motivation. So they could see, based off of the AI data, that vanilla is more in demand right now. But what are they going to do about that? How do they motivate somebody to start making that?
That's
by
right.
A gun? Hey, if you don't make more vanilla, you die?
Yeah, I mean, great point.
So right? It's the human motivation and incentive. And I just don't see, and I'm no expert in AI. I have done quite a bit of research into it. They're a long way away from being able to have like a creative mind, right? They can do logic and things like that. So figuring out that incentive and motivation piece, and you probably know as well as I do anecdotally, you know, I've met with friends who don't know what to do. What should I do for my business or my job? And I give them great ideas. Like, this is a $1 million idea. You can't get someone motivated from your idea, right? You have to get motivated on their own. And so that motive and incentive is a big piece.
It sure is. So I think that's a great segue into our next topic. And I know we're running short on time here, but what can people do? I mean, what can the average Joe, let's say in the United States or Australia or the UK that's watching this and saying, oh my gosh, well, this makes so much sense. I mean, they're really speaking my language, but I just got this 9-to-5 job. I've got a family. I've got a wife. I mean, you know, my kids aren't going to want to move to some, you know, off the grid or anything like that. What can they do?
Yeah. So that's the question that we spend all day trying to figure out, right? The first thing I would say is you need to be paying attention. You need to understand these issues, because if you don't, the world is passing you by super fast. And these people are making plans. And if you don't know what they are, you're going to be left out. So the first thing is just invest in your own education, pay attention. You're watching this video, so you're doing a good job. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say is, like, passive investing, in my opinion, is dead. The old 60-40 split ain't going to work anymore. Yeah. Again, as I said, Jim Rickard said, the world we're going into is not the world we came out of. And so I think we have to be tactically managing. And I'm not talking about day trading, but we have to be tactically managing, because all these things that the Fed does creates bubbles, and they create prices to move and assets and money to move. And so you need to be able to kind of tactically manage that a little bit. And then I would say we want to be really focusing on things that we can get that are outside of the financial system, which, of course, gold and Bitcoin fall into that. I think that commodities overall, real tangible things, are going to do better in a world of fake money. And then the other thing that I pound the table on, and I got this from Kiyosaki, who we're going to go hang out with this weekend, and that is investing for cash flow. And I know, of course, you are big on that as well, right? And that's you're retired as well. And I mean, I've seen it time and time again. If somebody could focus on building up cash flow, man, within 5 years or 10 years, a lot of times they could be retired. Yeah. And so focus on investing for cash flow, focus on assets that are outside the financial system, tactically manage what you have, and then pay attention.
Okay, fantastic advice. So, Mark, thank you very much for your time. It was a pleasure speaking to you, as always. This weekend is going to be awesome. We're going to get out there. We're going to have some beers. We're going to have some good food. We're going to whack the golf ball around a little bit at Top Golf, and we'll put the link to the landing page where you can do like a RSVP. We'll put that in the description below while the editors put that in there. I'll see you Friday morning at the airport, buddy. I'll pick you up bright and early, and we're going to have a great time. I look forward to it. And Mark, before we go, for all of you who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
Well, the best place to follow me is just on my YouTube channel, just Mark Moss on YouTube. And I'm also very active on Twitter. So just the number one at Mark Moss on Twitter.
Awesome. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.